This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin, and here's what's coming up.
Currently, around 70 people still reportedly detained for exercising their legitimate human rights. And some of them are serving lengthy sentences, while others are still in pretrial detention.
That was UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville expressing concern about increasingly repressive actions by the Algerian government against protesters. This story and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Tunisia's economy faces serious challenges with public debt at 90% of GDP, and the COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated socioeconomic inequalities. That's led to public anger and ongoing protests. To address some of the economic needs, a Tunisian delegation is visiting Washington this week to negotiate a new financing program with the International Monetary Fund. The delegation seeks a new loan guarantee from the U.S. government. William Lawrence is a professor of political science at the American University in Washington. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi. Here's a clip of their conversation.
The U.S. and the IMF can help Tunisia by offering as much assistance as possible with the lowest number of conditions. There was a report that came out around 2 years ago from the World Bank and IMF arguing that they have failed over the last 50 years in their loan programs, increasing poverty, depriving countries of crucial resources, and actually making the situation worse in countries in many cases. And yet they're going about the same policies they've always gone about, which is too much austerity, too many sacrifices for monetary gain and macroeconomic gains at the expense of the larger economy. The IMF is asking Tunisia to cut subsidies, to reduce public sector wages, and to make other sacrifices that will actually increase misery in Tunisia over the short term, when in fact the solution's the other way around. You have to grow and diversify the private sector economy first, then make your public sector cuts in subsequent years, not before you've done the turnaround. So Tunisia has to address the causes of its revolution before fixing its macroeconomic solution, rather than fixing its macroeconomic solution first. You may remember that the Tunisian Arab Spring began with a self-immolation of a private sector vendor who didn't have access to running businesses. And I've been debating this for years with Tunisian economists and bank officials who were continuing to attack the private sector and informal sector rather than promoting them. And they've started to come around to my position, saying that actually the way you help Tunisia's economy is to grow their way out of the situation by helping the informal sector rather than banning it, and that the public sector solutions can't be the highest priority. They have to be private sector solutions.
So what does the new economic reform plan in Tunisia entail?
We know that it involves subsidy cuts, and there need to be better targeted subsidies. We know that the ways they would like to cut public sector wages is, for example, by paying some people 25% of their wages for not working, or 60% of their wages for working half-time, or 80% of their wages for working 4 days instead of five. But already there was an agreement apparently between the labor unions and the government prior to their trip to Washington on the broad outlines of the plan. And then as these details have started to trickle out, the labor unions are saying, no, we didn't agree to that. And so it's actually made the negotiations going on here in Washington harder. There are other aspects of the plan that are less controversial, like liberalizing the distribution of certain products like tobacco, reducing the income tax from 35% down to 15%. But ultimately, in the end, keeping a lot of subsidies that help poor people, like those on fuel, for example, and reviving private sector investment is what Tunisia needs, rather than just macroeconomic reforms to reduce inflation that then increase poverty and fire people from their jobs.
So what are the main challenges facing Tunisia now, especially with the COVID negative impact on both tourism and trade?
Not enough jobs and inflation. The reason the delegation is here is they need to help reduce inflation. So they do have to get the macro economic situation under control. And the way you do that is to have a $4 billion loan without shrinking the economy and the public sector wage tab so radically at the beginning that you actually aggravate everything. You need to support the economy without firing people. You need to support the economy without cutting too many subsidies. Tunisia will only be able to survive its current economic crisis emerging from the COVID pandemic by increasing, not decreasing, the number of private and public sector jobs. And the main way to do that is to actually decrease what the government tells the private sector how it has to operate and just allow it and promote its operation by investing in it. Tunisia has a lot of wonderful advantages in terms of its human resources, but we have to create a context whereby that economy can flourish.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. At least two people were killed and dozens wounded late yesterday when Sudanese security forces broke up a rally demanding justice for protesters killed during anti-government demonstrations 2 years ago. Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok said he was shocked by the killings, calling it a, quote, crime to use live bullets against peaceful protesters, end quote. The protesters had gathered near the Qiyada Army headquarters in Khartoum, which was the site of a months-long demonstration and sit-in in 2019, calling for civilian rule following the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir. Sudan's opposition said more than 120 people died when security forces broke up that protest. The protesters yesterday were demanding the completion of an investigation into the 2019 massacre and that those responsible be held accountable. UN human rights officials are expressing concern about increasingly repressive actions by the Algerian government, which they say is stifling people's rights to freedom of opinion and assembly. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Demonstrations have not been held in the streets of Algeria for most of the past year because of COVID-19. However, since they resumed 3 months ago on February 13th, the UN Human Rights Office says it has received reports of security forces using unnecessary and disproportionate force against peaceful protesters. The protesters are part of the Hirak movement, which began 2 years ago after then-President Abdelaziz Bouteflika announced he would run for a fifth term. While he is no longer in power, the movement continues to call for the ouster of the ruling elite, which it considers corrupt. Human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says student marches have been blocked from going ahead on four occasions in April and May, and security forces have arrested hundreds of protesters. He notes some detainees reportedly were released after being forced to sign a document promising not to participate in protests.
Currently, around 70 people are still reportedly detained for exercising their legitimate human rights. And some of them are serving lengthy sentences while others are still in pretrial detention. New allegations of physical and sexual violence in detention have also been surfacing in recent days.
Colville says activists, human rights defenders, journalists, and ordinary citizens peacefully expressing dissent continue to face criminal prosecution. He notes Hirak activists continue to be prosecuted even after a presidential pardon was announced in February.
So we urge the Algerian authorities to stop using violence to disperse peaceful demonstrations, to halt arbitrary arrests and detention of individuals for exercising their fundamental rights to freedom of opinion, expression, and peaceful assembly, and to cease all forms of harassment and intimidation against them.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on Algerian authorities to conduct prompt, impartial, and effective investigations into all allegations of human rights violations, to hold perpetrators accountable, and to provide redress for the victims. In response to past criticisms, government spokesman and Minister of Communication, Amar Belhimer, has said that people who are arrested are not detained by the judiciary for expressing their opinion, but for reasons relating to maintaining public security. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now in Uganda, Yoweri Museveni has been sworn in for a sixth five-year term as Uganda's president. The ceremony was held amid tight security in Kampala and the surrounding areas. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
A number of African presidents were on hand as the 76-year-old Museveni, one of the continent's longest-serving leaders, was sworn in. Among them were Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya, Samia Suluhu of Tanzania, Nana Akufo-Addo of Ghana, Emmerson Mnangagwa of Zimbabwe, and Salva Kiir of South Sudan. Other heads of state included Somalia's Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo, DRC's Felix Tshisekedi, and Burundi's Evariste Ndayishimiye. The Chief Justice administered the oaths of allegiance and the presidency.
I, Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, swear in the name of the Almighty God that I shall faithfully exercise the functions of the President of Uganda and shall uphold, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution and observe the laws of Uganda, and that I shall promote the welfare of the people of Uganda. So help me God.
Museveni has challenged his fellow leaders to work for economic empowerment of Africans.
I would therefore like to use this occasion to remind the African fraternity that economic and, where possible, political integration in Africa is a sine qua non of the success for Africa. If we are to address the issue of the prosperity of our people and strategic security of Africa, I'm glad we are working on the continental free trade area for the common market of the whole of Africa, and on the Confederation of East Africa as a first step to the East African Political Federation.
Security has been tight in and around Kampala and in major opposition strongholds. Officers sealed off the offices of opposition party National Unity Platform, where members had planned to converge for prayers and fasting against extrajudicial killings in the country and what they called bad governance by the Museveni government. Museveni has been Uganda's president since 1986. He won the January election, beating 10 other candidates, including his major challenger, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, a.k.a. Bobi Wine. Wine, a popular musician who has attracted a strong youth following, has since disputed the outcome of the election, claiming it was marred by rigging and electoral violence. He also said the COVID-19 restrictions on public gatherings weren't enforced against Museveni supporters. He tried to challenge the outcome in court, but dropped the case, alleging bias from the judges. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
In Ghana, a new hashtag #FixTheCountry, has been trending in response to increases in prices of fuel and food staples, high taxes, and unstable power supply. Mavis Okere in Ghana has more on that viral campaign.
Some are accusing the government of deceiving them into believing it has the power to change things. The hashtag #FixMotherGhana has garnered over 71,000 tweets. So far, the Ghana Police Service secured a restraining order for a Fix the Country Now protest Sunday. Instead, agitated youth across the country took to social media to air their frustration. Like in traditional protests, they wore red and black and hosted placards reading #FixTheCountry, #WeAreAngry, low salaries and wages, bad roads, and end corruption. Joshua Boydo, who started the #FixTheCountry campaign, says he wanted to get the government to listen to issues bedeviling the country and seek the appropriate means to resolve them. He says the campaign was meant to amplify sentiments such as rising youth unemployment, insufficient health systems, skyrocketing rents, and poor road networks. Boydo says the campaign is a wake-up call for government on issues affecting the youth and development of the country.
This hashtag is not an attack on the government. It's not in support of the opposition. It's a hashtag calling for change in our governance. It's a hashtag that presents itself as an opportunity to this current government as well. I feel if they listen to the youth and they follow whatever is happening on social media, they will know what the Ghanaian citizens need to survive, and they will do that and change the history of this country.
He says successive governments have failed to live up to expectations and that people are often unable to get their voices heard after elections. Boy Doe says the campaign aimed to pressure the government to go beyond the rhetoric on fixing the economy and create and implement policies and projects to better the lives of citizens.
So I feel they should pay more attention to us and listen to the pleas of the people and make things work for us. That's all we are asking. We want to see hospitals repaired. We want to see good roads. We want to see get clean drinking water for the people, employment, and a whole lot. And I feel this is just the right time for this government.
Finance Minister Ken Oforiatta on Sunday assured protesters that the government is committed to doing its best to fast-tracking policies to improve the livelihoods of its citizens. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
Next, we go to South Africa, where pressure is building on one of the ruling party's most senior members to apologize to the nation for an attempt to suspend President Cyril Ramaphosa. The African National Congress, or ANC, recently ordered its Secretary General, Ace Magashule, to step down from the organization pending the outcome of his upcoming criminal trial for alleged corruption. Magashule responded by serving a, quote, letter of suspension, end quote, on Ramaphosa, claiming the president himself is implicated in graft. Darren Taylor reports.
At a media briefing, ANC Acting Secretary General Jesse Duarte brought Magashule to another crossroads.
This letter that suspends a sitting president in a manner that it was done could have had many repercussions. People started calling from other countries to verify. So there is a need for a retraction. So if he fails to do so, the ANC will institute disciplinary procedures in accordance with the ANC constitution.
But in an appearance on state television, Magashule said the ANC's National Executive Committee, or NEC, was treating him unfairly.
The National Executive itself has been conflicted in this matter. There have been the judges, the prosecutor, the jury, the evidence presenters. You can't factionalize the resolutions of the National Conference, and you want to usurp what branches actually said in NASREC.
Magashule suggesting here that he was elected by ANC branches at the party's conference in Johannesburg in late 2017. As such, he says, only they have the authority to terminate his membership. He says party leaders are violating their own resolutions in their action against him.
There is a Bill of Rights, there is the Constitution of the country, the laws of the land, the Constitution of the ANC, presumption of innocence until proven otherwise. Read all those things and processes which are supposed to be happening.
But political analyst Mkhwebisi Ndletshana says ANC leadership is actually mollycoddling Magashule, as it did when it allowed him more than 30 days to resign voluntarily, which he subsequently refused to do.
He went on to issue this letter that was completely unauthorized. That was a much bigger infraction than not stepping down. And yet again, what they have done is simply to say that he must issue an apology. So there's a lot of leniency that has been shown here.
Leaked recordings from the weekend's NEC meeting reveal an ANC at war with itself and deeply anxious about its future. In one of the audio clips, former President Thabo Mbeki refers to comments made by ANC Women's League leader Batabile Dlamini.
The central point that Comrade Batabile made is this, that the movement is about to collapse. I'm saying, Comrade Chair, you have this question. Do we still have any organization called the ANC?
In another recording, senior ANC official Dakota Lekwete says all party members must be treated equally.
We might smell out the SG, but there are many of us here who are even worse than him in terms of corruption. And until we are also...
Lekwete can be heard saying, we might send out the SG, namely Magashule, but there are many of us here who are even worse than him in terms of corruption.
I don't want to defend the SG, I'm not his lawyer or representative, but I think it will only be fair that all corrupt elements in our movement, we must deal with them. without any prejudices.
The leaked recordings offer a fascinating insight into what gets said during what are meant to be top secret ANC meetings. For opposition parties, civil society groups and citizens, they confirm what's long been suspected, that far from containing just a few bad apples, the ruling party's rot is widespread. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Next, we go to Zimbabwe, where the country's debt for electricity imports from neighboring Mozambique has spiked over the past year, amid fears that energy supply within the region might be disrupted by insurgency and insecurity in Mozambique. Eddie Gondo gives us more on this story.
Zimbabwe Electricity Supply Authority's debt to hydroelectric at Dikahora Basa HCB rose to US$97 million last year, up from US$45 million in 2019, according to the Mozambican power supplier. In its financial statements for 2020, HCB revealed that Zimbabwe was its second largest debtor after Mozambique utility EDM. HCB operates the Kabora Basa Dam on the Zambezi River, a major power supplier to the region. The Zimbabwe Energy Regulatory Authority, ZERA, says ZESA imports about 30% of its energy requirements to make up for shortfalls at its aging plants. Analysts say that as long as the country relies on imports, it is exposed to factors beyond its control. Economic analyst Reggie Shoko weighs in, saying the country is too dependent on outdated power generation equipment. Shoko and others say planners need to consider sustainability and alternatives.
It's catching up now because of the increase in population. For a long time, we were operating an economy that was operating below capacity in terms of production. Yes, demand had been very minimal. But with the advent of almost everyone trying to mine agriculture, you now see the requirements that we have a serious deficit. And power generation on its own, it's a big infrastructure development that needs long-term planning.
Shoko says it's worrisome that SADC does not have a proper and stable power generational policy to sustain future demands given the worsening security situation in Mozambique.
We need to, as a country, to look at the potential of harnessing renewables like sun, wind over the issue of thermal power stations, because one day coal will disappear.
Mambo Hamaindu, a Zambian analyst, concurs, saying many countries in the region have power shortfalls and Mozambique's political situation has a domino effect.
The security situation in Mozambique is something which is of concern and is worrying. I think it becomes an imperative that the SADC looks at this matter a bit more keenly and try and help resolve the situation in there, because as rightly noted from your question, as a region, we depend quite a lot on power that comes from Mozambique. It helps to supplement the deficiencies in terms of electricity that are in the surrounding countries. And as you might know, electricity is one of the biggest factors of production.
Analysts like Hamaundu and Shoko say electricity supply lies at the heart of the region's economic viability, but countries are not doing enough to explore alternatives and tamp down the growing insecurity threat. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Last of all, an update on the conflict in northern Nigeria. Nigerian troops fought off a raid late yesterday by suspected Islamist insurgents in Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State in the northeast. The attack came as many Muslim residents observing Ramadan were about to break their fast for the day. Witnesses say militants riding motorcycles and trucks with mounted guns stormed into the area of Jidiripolo on the outskirts of the city. Residents said they had to flee the area as army forces fought back. The Boko Haram militant group has battled to take control of the region for a decade, and other Islamist groups also have fought in the area. Nigeria has seen a surge in violence this year. That wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent, 24/7, please visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mikhail Yabaro, and our editor, Paul Alexander, thank you for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC right